Ну что, давайте начнем. Очень чувствительный микрофон. Добрый день всем. Приветствую вас на презентации по виртуальным машинам, виртуальным сетям Windows Azure. Меня зовут Марк Леснович. Я работаю в группе Windows Azure около 2,5 лет. Я являюсь ведущим архитектором по функции инфраструктуры как сервис. У нас примерно час, много материала. И я хочу вам дать обзор предложения категории инфраструктура как сервис, который мы, извините, звук пропал. Ага, все, заработал. Добрый день всем. Итак, сколько из вас использовал Windows Azure уже? Поднимите руки, пожалуйста. Ага, некоторые примерно половина. А кто из вас создавали виртуальную машину на Windows Azure? Несколько. Так вот, те, кто знакомы с Windows Azure и следили за развитием этого сервиса с самого начала, знают, что этот выпуск функции, который появился этим летом, немножечко удивил, потому что Windows Azure начало развитие как платформа, как сервис. А идея в том, чтобы превратить Azure в платформу, которая была бы, обеспечила бы разработчикам очень возможность с легкостью разворачивать высокодоступные приложения в облаке. И это корни Azure. Если посмотреть на этот слайд, начнем слева. И это задача, собственно, выполнялась на базе внутренних разработок Microsoft. Но со временем мы изменили свою задачу превратить ее в платформу для мира. Наши продавцы общались с заказчиками, говорили с ними об будущем облачных технологий. И заказчики проникались идеей облачных вычислений и тут же задавали вопрос, а как нам взять и свои существующие приложения выложить в облако? Я верю в ценность облака, но я считаю, что новые приложения, если они будут работать в облаке, это очень хорошо. Но что делать с моими существующими приложениями? Вот что они говорили. И на этом наши разговоры неожиданно заканчивались. И мы поняли тогда, что вот этот переход, который осуществлялся в сторону облака, займет определенное время. И то, что заказчики захотят свои существующие приложения выкладывать в облако, это факт. И мы, если посмотреть на те шаги, в ходе которых осуществляется эволюция облака, Azure, вы, так сказать, реализовали возможности использования существующих программных средств. Например, многие разработчики приложения хотят нативный код использовать. Вот первоначальная платформа, она была .NET с частичным доверием, только они также хотели туда выкладывать код, который имеет права администрирования, или настраиваемый код с библиотеками. Со временем мы обеспечивали им такую возможность. Конечно, в конечном итоге заказчики сказали бы, мы хотим туда положить и SQL Server, и SharePoint, и другие Windows Server приложения, как мы говорим, унаследованного типа. Вот. С тем, чтобы воспользоваться, так сказать, возможностями, которые предоставляет облако, обеспечение возможности высокой готовности. Но этим летом мы выпустили предварительную версию Infrastructure as a Service, или то, как мы назвали, Virtual Machines на базе Azure, которая значительно расширила возможности использования существующих приложений серверных. И о этом я буду говорить. Вот этот контраст противостояния заявленными целями развития платформы Azure и тем направлением, в котором эта платформа стала развиваться сейчас, очень четко показывают различия. Вот функция, которая у нас была несколько лет назад, VMRoll, и теперь новый Virtual Machine. Основной принцип высокодоступного облака, масштабируемая модель развернутого приложения, это stateless модель. Вы создаете высокую готовность, создавая клоны, реплики инстансов на каждом уровне и обеспечиваете горизонтальное масштабирование за счет создания большого количества клонов или инстансов. И у каждого этого инстанса нет никакой собственной ценности. То есть просто-напросто, если он сбоит, вы воссоздаете ее на другом сервере. А информация о состоянии, она управляется снаружи, на уровне уровня. И это и высоконадежная облачная система хранения, такие как Azure. Раньше SQL Azure это называлось, мы теперь называем это Windows Azure Databases. И вот это была функция VMRoll. Она была без сохранения информации о состоянии. Вы берете VHD, а потом штампуете виртуальную машину на основе этого VHD. И если что-то падает, то все данные, которые генерировались локально на этом сервере, они терялись. В противоположность, а технология Virtual Machines, и так же, как и система хранения, которая есть у заказчиков, они поддерживают информацию о хранении. Например, SQL Server. SQL Server, как база данных, она сконструирована таким образом, чтобы сохранять данные в случае сбоя. И там реализованы соответствующие механизмы, которые обеспечивают правильную обработку коммитов данных. И в этом есть большая разница. Вот по первой строке. Есть и другие различия между VMRoll и Virtual Machines. Когда мы начали разрабатывать эту функцию примерно полтора года назад, вместо того, чтобы идти по очевидному пути, то есть взять и посмотреть, как это сделал Amazon на сервисе EC2, то есть это инфраструктура как сервис, они были пионером в этой области. Вот, просто посмотреть на то, что они сделали, и сказать, можем это сделать, можем это сделать, можем. Так вот, вместо этого подхода мы решили сфокусироваться на сценариях. Скажем, какие основные функции, сценарии, которые нам нужно реализовать в первой версии вот этой функции. И вот такой список у нас возник. Мы хотели сделать так, чтобы, так сказать, это удовлетворяло существующие задачи ИТ-специалистов, то есть люди, которые не являются разработчиками, но занимаются эксплуатацией. И возможность создания виртуальных машин, развернутое программное обеспечение на этих виртуальных машинах, управление виртуальными машинами. Ну, те задачи, которые выполняют это специалисты. То есть на XML, чтобы XML там не было, чтобы Visual Studio там не было, как в случае с Platform as a Service. Дальше.
The applications that they want to migrate, then it's no use to them. And so we need to make sure that all of those key server applications that are the heart of enterprise line of business applications and customer facing applications are supported, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, that it's easy to manage the storage, that I'll talk more about that, how we have a different perspective on this than Amazon does when it comes to managing the storage for these virtual machines, that it needed to support high availability out of the gate, so by their nature, these server applications are not very available. They run on single machines typically, and if that machine fails, the application's taken downtime. But there are some applications, SQL Server being one of them, where you can create highly available solutions for it, and we wanted to be able to support that on the commodity data center infrastructure that we've created. And I'll talk more about the features that we enabled to make that possible. Advanced networking is required, especially when you're talking about IT pros migrating to the cloud. They like secure tunnels from their on-premises networks into the cloud, not having to go outside to the publicly exposed internet to access their applications. And so that was a key requirement in the networking space, is being able to not only support the networking requirements of the server applications, but also the IT pros' expectations around how they connect securely into a cloud environment. And then finally, we haven't lost focus of our main mission with the cloud, which is platform as a service, which is making it easy for developers to create highly available cloud scale applications. We like I said, we view this movement of these server applications to the cloud as a transitionary one, and we believe that companies will continue to invest in their applications will go for a cloud design point and stop developing for the server model of scale up through highly expensive high availability and go to scale out commodity availability. And then finally, we had a slogan as we developed this feature that was very important for our own developers, which was, if it requires a developer, then it's not infrastructure as a service. In other words, just because we're Microsoft and we also develop Active Directory, our Azure developers couldn't go to the Active Directory team and say, please change Active Directory to work better on Windows Azure or to work on Windows Azure's infrastructure as a service. That's simply not an escape hatch we could pull, because we could maybe pull it for SQL Server and Active Directory, but not the many other server applications that we don't control that customers want to run on Windows Azure. And if it requires a developer to go to modify the application, then we actually haven't accomplished what we set out to accomplish, which is supporting these server applications. These are the images available at preview. How many of you have seen a virtual machine created on Windows Azure? So a few of you have. I'm going to go and pop open the management portal and create one for you. And there's a pretty simple experience to it. Here's the management portal for Windows Azure. If you go to the new button down here and go to compute, and go to virtual machine. I'm going to select from gallery here. Instead of quick create, lets you just fill in a few options and very quickly create a virtual machine. I'm going to pick from gallery so we can pick some more advanced options, and you can see some of the selections available to you, starting right here, which is the list of supported operating systems that we have from, of course, versions of Linux, and I'll talk more about that in a second, to the best operating system, of course. This one. I'm going to go ahead and pick a Linux distribution here. And we're running at a odd screen real estate. Now, the question it's going to ask me right here is to pick a virtual machine name. I'm going to pick TE12RU-Linux for TechEd 2012 Russia. Pick a password for my new machine, press next. And this question's interesting, and I'm going to spend some time talking about this choice right here, whether I want to make this a standalone virtual machine or I want to connect it to an existing virtual machine. And this one has implications when it comes to managing the virtual machine, as well as networking implications that I'll demonstrate. I'm going to let this one be a standalone virtual machine, and then it asks me the storage account. The storage account is significant because that's where the virtual machine images are going to be stored. I'm going to let it pick a default storage account. Oops, I need to pick a DNS name. And I'm going to pick the same one, T12RU-Linux. And let's see if anybody's picked that. No, they haven't. And then press OK. And then this last option right here, availability set, is one of those high availability features, which I'll talk about later. And we're going to just press OK on that. Now, it's going to take 3 or 4 minutes for that Linux virtual machine to spin up in the cloud. And when it's finished, we'll go take a look at it. But I want to stop and just talk about the supported operating systems that we've got right now. You can see from that list that you saw briefly, Server 2008 R2, Server 2012, of course, as well as various distributions of Linux. We worked closely with these Linux vendors to make it possible for them to bring their Linux distributions and offer them on Windows Azure, and we're working with other ones, of course. This list is still preliminary and will expand over time. We also, like I said, wanted to support key server applications. And the ones that we've got control over, of course, we could go after them first. The number one application, though, the most important one we found talking to customers, is, of course, SQL Server. So we worked very closely from the start with the SQL Server team to make sure that SQL Server not only runs on Windows Azure, but runs well on Windows Azure. So we've been working with them on performance benchmarks to make sure that we're actually delivered good SQL performance on top of Windows Azure. You can see we've also worked with these other teams, Active Directory and SharePoint. Of course, if you take a look at those first three, SharePoint, SQL, and Active Directory, SharePoint Farm requires all three of those, and SharePoint Farms, it turns out, very commonly used in enterprise line of business applications as well as customer-facing applications. So this was absolutely necessary to hit these first three and hit them well. And then lastly, BizTalk is also right now, BizTalk 2010 is in CTP form on Windows Azure as well, supported. And we're also working with other teams in Microsoft to bring their applications on board. It's important to recognize that supported here means officially supported, not just you can bring it and it runs and it does okay, but actually these product groups are signed up to say, if you've got a problem with SQL Server and you call customer service and you tell them that it's running on Windows Azure, they just won't hang up the phone on you, but they'll actually try to help you as best as they can. Let's talk about virtual machines and cloud services, because when you saw me enter that selection of making a standalone virtual machine, I told you that there was networking and management implications. So the portal can be a little confusing to somebody that knows just a little more than the somebody that's approaching Azure for the first time. And that's because the portal's experience is designed for somebody that never has used Windows Azure and is coming and says, I want to create a virtual machine. What do I need to do? When they create a standalone virtual machine, they're actually creating something called a cloud service, although they don't see it. Now, what is a cloud service? Cloud service is a concept that comes from our platform as a service offering. It lets you create basically a container of tiers of an application. So if you think of your canonical two or three tier application with a front end tier and a middle tier, worker tier, or business logic tier, and then a back-end storage tier, you, in platform as a service, Windows Azure, you would model each of those as what are called roles. And you would create a web role typically for the front end, and a worker role for the middle tier, and then your storage tier would be Windows Azure Storage or Windows Azure Databases. When you create these tiers, these roles, you specify the number of virtual machines you want, the number of instances, they're called, of that tier. So the instances are the VMs. So this is a little confusing because we actually, in even platform as a service, are running virtual machines, the code in virtual machines, except they're part of what are called web and worker roles. When you can see in this cloud service that because they're part of it, they can see each other from a networking perspective. They can talk to each other. Whereas they can't talk to the virtual machines of other cloud services using their private IP addresses in the data center because each one's in its own virtual LAN. And this is part of the security model of Windows Azure, is every cloud service is isolated from every other one from a networking perspective. And also, you can manage these as a unit, so you can shut down the whole cloud service if you'd like to. When I created that Linux virtual machine, and I said standalone, I created, like I said, a hidden cloud service, an implicit one that wasn't visible to me in the portal. It is visible using other APIs, though. If I called the service management APIs, I would see a cloud service there. And this is where it can become a little confusing, which is why I spend a few minutes explaining this, because I don't want you to get confused when you fall into the belief that the portal's trying to push you towards, which is there's virtual machines and there's cloud services, when actually there's cloud services, and there's two kinds of cloud services, the platform as a service cloud service and the infrastructure as a service cloud service. Because when you add, if I'd pick that add to an existing virtual machine in the portal, when I created that new Linux VM, what would have happened is that cloud service that was hidden before would become visible in the portal. And it would become clear that those two virtual machines are inside the same cloud service, which means they would be able to talk to each other from a networking perspective. I'll show you that difference when I get to the networking section. So let's talk about the difference between images and disks. And this, if anybody's familiar with SysPrep, how many people have used SysPrep before? So you're familiar already with this concept of an image versus a disk. An image is a generalized disk, basically. You can go stamp out new virtual machines from one, whereas a disk is a specialized image. It's actually bound to a VM. It's got a unique identity. You've given it a computer name, you've created an administrator account with a certain password on it, and you've started to put things on that virtual machine. And that is the model that we follow in Azure. When I went to the wizard there and I created a virtual machine, I was shown a list of images. Some of those images are platform images, ones that we store in the platform gallery. But then you can also create your own images by SysPrep specializing them and using the portal APIs to import them into your own gallery. So if I went to compute and said I wanted a new virtual machine, and I said from gallery, you can see over here there's platform images, and then there's my images. And I've got my own generalized SharePoint 2013 image here sitting in my gallery. And then there's my disks, which I don't have any disks that aren't attached to virtual machines, but if I did, they would show up there as well. Because a disk, like I said, is actually bound to a virtual machine. When I created that Linux VM, it took that Linux image and then created a disk from it. And now that disk is that Linux VM's operating system disk, customized for it. And I could shut down that virtual machine without deleting the disk and then go into the wizard like there, and that disk would show up, and I could go create another virtual machine and say, use this disk. And basically, I'm reincarnating that Linux virtual machine into another, or that Linux VHD into another Linux virtual machine. So that's the difference between images and disks. Most servers don't just run with one disk, though, the operating system disk. And if you've set up a SQL server, typically what you do is put the operating system on one disk and put your SQL server database and logs on different disks. We call those data disks. And the number of data disks you can attach to a virtual machine depends on the size of the virtual machine. These are the current virtual machine sizes we offer right now in Windows Azure. They start with an extra small, which is basically a quarter of a CPU, going up to what we call an extra large, which is an 8-CPU virtual machine with 14 gigabytes of RAM. And you can add up to 16 data disks to such a virtual machine. I've created a virtual machine with 16 data disks. And I'm going to show you how I created it to highlight the fact that we wanted to focus on IT pros. And what do IT pros like to do? Do they like to use GUIs? Do they like to use portals? No, they're much more hardcore than that. They like to use things like PowerShell. And so I've got a PowerShell script right here, which is what I use to create the VM that I'm going to show you in a second, where I add here, you can see that the image that I'm picking from is the Server 2012 data center image. I gave it a name, this cloud service that I'm putting this VM into. Here's where I specified where the VHDs would be created in Windows Azure Storage. And then here's where I'm adding disks one after another, and I'm adding actually 15 of them. That's the PowerShell script that created this VM, which is, let me cancel this wizard and go to virtual machines. And you can see that VM right here, Serve 2012, 16 terabytes. And one of the other things I'll stop and mention here while we're looking at this virtual machine is that we capture performance metrics from the virtual machine, from the hypervisor. Inside the hypervisor, we see CPU usage of the virtual machine, we see network I/O of the virtual machine, and disk I/O of the virtual machine, and that's what you can see in this graph here. And then if I scroll down, here you can see the OS disk as well as those data disks. I'm going to remote into this virtual machine. By remote, I mean RDP in. And this is where you will be able to see the 15 disks, and I'm going to add one. Oops. Let's see if I can remember the password. And what I'm going to, okay. Let's see if it's that password. I only use two passwords, so it's either one or the other. Huh. That's interesting. What was the password for that one? Let me give it one more try. Maybe I've just forgotten this password. Oh, there it is. All right, so I am going to make it in after all. We're going to take a look at the disks. But one of the things I can do, I've only got 15 data disks attached. I'll show you how easy it is to attach a disk. And this is the first time to log into this machine. You can see since I created it this morning by running the script again. In fact, why don't I, to save time, while that's logging in, I'm going to attach a disk here to attach the 16th data disk. And looks like I'm having lag on the portal. So attach an empty disk. And here we pick the size. The disks can be up to 1 terabyte in size. I used to think that a terabyte was how many gigabytes? 1,024. But I was wrong. It has to be 1,023. I think the portal guys don't know their math. But and so now it's adding a disk. And let's come back here. And I'm going to do Window key X to bring up Disk Manager. And we're going to see those 15 disks. And then in a few seconds, we'll see the 16th disk pop up. So I'm initializing those 15 disks. And then let's see. You can see disk 16. That's because it looks like it already arrived. No, there's a temporary disk. Each VM by default has an OS disk, one that's for temporary storage, and you can see the paging file is stored on this disk. This one will be actually lost. If the server fails, the data that's on this disk will be lost, so it doesn't persist. And in a few seconds, we're going to have that other disk pop up. And Windows is going to ask us to initialize it. Let's see if I can see how that's going over here. That's going to pop up in a second. So we'll take a look at that in a few minutes and come back. So up to 16 disks, so up to 16 terabytes of attached storage. One important consideration for when you create your server applications is where you put the data for that server application, because there's two different default policies depending on whether it's an OS disk or a data disk. For an OS disk, we cache the data locally on the server, and we do that because the OS has a pattern where it will write repeatedly to the same sections of the disk and occasionally flush and do write-throughs, but we find that we can get better performance for the operating system by caching the data locally. Like I said, we worked closely with the SQL team to figure out the best way to configure SQL, and we found that SQL workloads work best if we don't cache any data locally, because they're actually managing, just like SQL likes to do, it's its own operating system, its storage requirements itself. And so all of the reads and writes to a data disk go directly to Windows Azure Storage and don't get cached locally. What that means is if you create a SQL database and you put it on the operating system disk, you're not going to get the best performance out of SQL. The strong recommendation is if you've got a SQL database that is all being utilized, to put that database on a data disk. And so that's where this comes from. Now note, We make it possible to override these settings if you'd like to. These are just the defaults. So I mentioned earlier that one of our, I think, differentiators from the way that Amazon manages their virtual machines is, if you look at Amazon EC2, they store their VHDs in something called Elastic Block Store, EBS, whereas their general platform as a service storage solution is called S3. And they're two different storage solutions. They have two different sets of APIs. When we, and actually the EBS storage is kind of what we call the roach motel, which is roaches in this roach motel kind of traps. The roach goes in the motel, the little box, gets the poison, and it never comes out. And so we call the Amazon solution, it's like a roach motel, because you put your VHDs in there, and it's extremely hard to get them out. We wanted to make it easy for you to manage VHDs and to be very flexible about how you put VHDs up into Windows Azure and how you pull them out into Windows Azure. And what we decided to do is just leverage our existing platform as a service storage offering, which is already running at scale, already had documented published APIs, lots of tooling around support for it. And so we put our VHDs in Windows Azure Storage in something called a blob. So if you use platform as a service, you can store large chunks of data in blobs. And we just happen to use blobs to store these VHDs, what are called page blobs. And another benefit we get out of using Windows Azure Storage is Windows Azure Storage is highly durable. It guarantees that before a write is acknowledged back to client, that it's been triplicated in our data center on three different servers. So we can lose up to two servers and not lose your data. And of course, if we lose a server, the data begins to replicate so that we can then tolerate another server failure without, or multiple server failures without losing data. This, if you look at the Amazon outages over the last year, almost every one had an EBS impact that where Amazon directed the customers to go and restore from backup. And that is because their durability guarantee isn't as strong as what we've committed to delivering here with our storage solution. And I just to highlight for you how flexible the Windows Azure Storage approach is, I'm going to run an off-the-shelf application. It's called Cloud Explorer from Clumsy Leaf Software. It's a freeware utility. It's evolved for a couple years. It doesn't know anything about VHDs, but it just, because it uses the Windows Azure Storage APIs, is able to manage VHDs. So that 16 terabyte VM, its disks, I have my PowerShell script put into this folder called Big Storage, and here you can see them. All of the 15 disks that that script creates, shown here in the Storage Explorer. I can do things like download, or even copy. You want to see how long it takes to copy 1 terabyte in the cloud? Let's go see. I'm going to copy that to this backup folder. Okay, get ready. Done. It's actually magic. It's a sleight of hand, right? This is using copy-on-write technology. So it's actually not copying the data, but it's made essentially a snapshot of it. And that's how free basically snapshots are in a copy-on-write journaled file system that like Windows Azure Storage. So I've just made a snapshot of that 1 terabyte VHD. Let's go take a look at that VM and see if that disk, there's that new disk right here, which just showed up. So I'm going to initialize it. And then what I'm going to do is stripe them all together to get a 16 terabyte striped disk. We'll assign it a drive letter, and you definitely want to do a quick format of 16 terabytes. And so after a minute or two, we'll have a 16 terabyte disk attached to that VM. Let's talk about availability now and service level agreements. Our Windows Azure Platform as a Service offering guarantees 99.95% availability as long as you have at least two instances connected to the internet, publicly addressable. We offer that guarantee in the face of both hardware failures as well as software updates. So hardware failures being a server failure, a network switch failure, we will guarantee that at least one of those two instances will be still be reachable from the outside world. Likewise, for software updates, we update the operating system on our servers in our data center. We're running Hyper-V, of course, and so roughly once a month, we roll out updates that include security, performance, and reliability fixes, and we do it in an orchestrated way such that we don't take down the both of those instances at the same time. We'd only take down one at a time. Let me talk a little bit more about that in the context of infrastructure as a service. Here you can see that we can take advantage of the platform as a service availability features in infrastructure as a service to get that 99.95% availability for an application like SQL. Here we're using SQL mirroring with SQL Server primary and SQL Server secondary, and a SQL witness would be watching those two and electing a leader. But by taking advantage of the concept of fault domains and update domains in infrastructure as a service, we get that 99.95. The fault domain concept is related to infrastructure, physical failures, faults. Like I said, server failure or top of rack router failure or other networking gear failure. And each cloud service gets at least two, spread across at least two fault domains. So that cloud service I showed earlier, those instances on the front end would be in at least two different racks, so that if a top of rack router failed, only one of those instances would be affected. And cloud services can specify up to 20 of it update domains, meaning that when the Windows Azure is performing a software update, won't take down more than one update domain at a time. So instances of one of those 20 update domains will be affected as that software update rolls through our data center. So those capabilities, here's an example of the web and worker role. Four instances of a web role, four instances of a worker role. We'll spread them across at least two racks in the data center, which we call fault domains. And then we'll group them into update domains as well. So that, again, those instances in update domain one will be on servers that are being patched. When those servers are patched and those VMs are back up and running, then Azure will move to the next update domain and service and patch those servers. For VMs, to take advantage of the fault domain and update domain concept, we've introduced something called availability sets. You saw it in that last page of that wizard. It said, do you want an availability set? And that's what that was referring to, is this right here, where when you put multiple VMs into an availability set, then they'll be spread across fault domains as well as update domains in the same way that we saw for the platform as a service roles. So here you can see two front ends, two SQL servers. They'll be on separate fault domains, and they'll be in separate update domains as well. I've got a service that I've put up in the cloud that actually looks very similar to that. It is this cloud service right here, Fabricam Cloud App. And if I go to the Instances tab, I can see all of the instances in it. And it's got two SQL servers, a SQL witness, and two front ends running a web app. And if I scroll over, I can see the update domains and fault domains they're mapped to. Remember, the top two were SQL servers, and you can see one SQL server is in update domain 0, fault domain 0, and the other one's in update domain 1, fault domain 1. Here are the two web roles right here, and you can see that one's in fault domain 0, update domain 0, and the other one's in fault domain 1, update domain 1. So now this application's highly available in the face of software and hardware problems. And the way that I've configured that, if I go to one of these and I go to configure, you can see that it's part of an availability set, the web app availability set, the web availability set, and it's in there with the other front end, which is why they're in two different fault domain and update domains. Let's talk about the networking features that went along with this release to support server applications in those IT pro scenarios I mentioned. So one was that in our platform as a service offering, you have no control over the computer name, because in our platform as a service world, the computer name is not useful. In when one server of one tier, one role, wants to talk to another one of another tier, they use platform as a service APIs to say, what is the IP address of instance one in the worker role tier? And they get back the IP address. They never talk about computer names. Of course, server applications, the way they talk to each other is by using DNS and talking computer names. So we needed to bring that support into Windows Azure. We also wanted to make it possible for you to bring your own DNS server into Windows Azure. And I'll demonstrate why that is necessary. Either an on-premise DNS server, a DNS server you put up in the cloud, or even a public DNS service. And then server applications talk protocols besides TCP, which was the only one that Azure supported when we started implementing these features. Of course, they talk UDP, and they also talk ICMP. We also wanted to support what are called port-forwarded endpoints, which I'll talk about more in a minute, and then also custom load balancer health probes, which I'll also talk more about. Let's talk about port-forwarding endpoints, input endpoints. With our platform as a service, with our current offering, each cloud service gets a unique public IP address, an IPv4 publicly routable IP address. We call it a VIP, or virtual IP address. It belongs to a cloud service for the lifetime of the cloud service, but it only gets one. So we faced a challenge when we enabled RDP for our platform as a service VMs, because when you RDP, you want to RDP to one instance. You generally don't say RDP into any instance, I don't care. You say, no, I want to talk to that one. So we needed to support that with platform as a service, and the way we did is by putting RDP forwarders inside the VMs when you enable RDP. So if you end up on one, it says, oh, that's not me, let me forward you to the right one, and it forwards it. One of our criteria for shipping infrastructure as a service is no agent required. So we wanted to make it so you could just bring a stock Hyper-V VM VHD and put it up in Windows Azure. And assuming it was designed to work in our VMs in the environment, then it would just work. You wouldn't have to stick in a Windows Azure agent to get it to work. So we couldn't rely on forwarding. So we had to come up with another networking solution to let it make it possible for you to RDP or talk to an individual VM in a cloud service using that public IP address. And for that, we use what's called port forwarding. Let me demonstrate port forwarding by showing you that in that cloud service that we were just looking at, where I've got two front ends here, Web Apps Manager and Web Apps Manager. Let me go here. These two front ends here. If I click on one of them, I get this connect button, and that will let me connect to it. When I go to endpoints, I can see the mappings of its public ports, the ones that are reachable from the internet, to its internal ports. And there's three ports that have been mapped onto this VM. By default, when you create a VM with the portal, you'll always get RDP, and it's a public port here, 55.182. If those of you familiar with RDP know that that's not the standard RDP port, but this one is over here, private port 3389. What this says is that I can connect to the public IP address at port 55.182, and I will then be reaching port 3389 on this particular VM. If I go to this other Web Apps Manager, I can see that its RDP port on the public IP address is 62.214, and its private port is 3389. And this is what's called port forwarding. So a public port on the public VIP gets mapped to a private port on a specific virtual machine. Another requirement for high availability is load balancing. So besides just being able to tolerate failures, we want our front ends to be able to accept traffic from the outside world. And if one of those VMs goes down, to have traffic automatically routed to the healthy VMs while that one VM is being repaired and coming back online. When you create a web role and you create a port on it in the platform as a service world, it by default gets load balanced. So I could create that two-tier platform as a service app with a web role, say port 80 is the input endpoint, and now port 80 would be load balanced. And each instance would have port 80 private mapped to port 80 public, and the load balancer would then multiplex requests or connections coming in from the outside. To make that same capability available for infrastructure as a service, where we have those two front ends in that application, we want them to be load balanced, we can add them to what's called a load balanced set. And once they're in the load balanced set, then they also have a load balanced port that the load balancer will automatically spray traffic across. Let's go back to that application. And you can see that I've got one of these here, the web input endpoint, port 80 public, port 80 private, and it's load balanced. And you can see the same thing here for the other instance. And the way that that's configured here is when I say edit endpoint, you can see that that's where I gave it the name, the protocol, the public port 80, the private port that it maps to, and then you can see that it's part of this load balance set with that other front end. So what I've got here is a tier that's both highly available from a software update, a hardware failure, as well as from traffic from the outside world through load balancing. Now in platform as a service, we've got that agent in there that can respond to health probes from the load balancer. And it sits there and responds to pings every 15 seconds from the load balancer to say it's healthy or not. With infrastructure as a service, no agent, so we need to let you specify how you want the load balancer to query the health of an instance. So we call these load balancer custom probes, and you can specify a port as well as a path. You can see, like, I could create a website with health.aspx, and now the load balancer is going to do an HTTP GET on that path at the port you specify every 15 seconds to see if that instance is healthy. And then you could if that instance is on a server that fails, it's going to stop responding, or you could have your own application say stop responding to be shut off traffic to that instance if it becomes unhealthy from an application perspective. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is our cross-premise connectivity, the tunneling feature. A couple years ago, we introduced something called Windows Azure Connect. Windows Azure Connect is an agent-based point-to-point tunneling solution. You put an agent on the machine on-premise that you want to create have a tunneling endpoint to the cloud, and then you put the other agent on the VM in the cloud that you want to serve as the other end of that tunnel. And then an IPsec tunnel is created between them. That works fine for dev test scenarios. It turns out that IT pros don't really like that solution because they don't like putting agents everywhere, especially not in the case where you want to domain join machines that are in the cloud to machines that are to a domain that's on-premise, because you'd have to put the agent on the domain controller. And the domain controller is like sacred ground when it comes to IT pros. Nothing goes near the domain controller, certainly not an agent. So as part of this virtual networking features, we introduced Windows Azure Virtual Network, which lets you create, it has two features basically in one. One is a virtual networking overlay. So you can overlay IP addresses on top of our natively granted IP address ranges in the cloud. So this allows you to bring your own subnets up into Windows Azure to make them extensions of your own IP address range that you've got working on-premise, your private IP space. And it also lets you create virtual networking containers of multiple cloud services or VMs that belong to different cloud services. I mentioned that a cloud service is a networking boundary, but you can put VMs of different cloud services into a networking boundary using virtual networks. So that's actually the example that I've got here with this application, which the one that we've been looking at is a cloud application that is part of a virtual network, and it's domain joined to a domain that's running under somebody's desk at Microsoft on a server there. And I'll show you that. This application right here of this Web Apps Manager, by the way, this is the Web Apps Manager website. And I'm going to log in so you can see it. And what this is going to do is show me the name of the machine that it's running on. There's Web Apps Manager, as well as its SQL connection string. And there you can see that it's connected to that SQL mirror. There's the prime data source, and there's the failover partner of that SQL mirror, part of that connection string. If I go to the virtual networking tab, I've got this app VNet, and this shows me the subnets that I've defined up in the cloud. The gateway connection here, the green shows us that it's healthy, so that guy hasn't kicked the server underneath his desk, fortunately, for this demo. And then here's the on-premise end of that gateway, which is a VPN device. Shows us some data statistics, and here are all the VMs that are part of this virtual network, including those Web Apps Manager, the SQL Witness, and those T-SQL servers. And then you can see I've also joined a number of other PaaS web roles to that virtual network as well. So this works for IaaS as well as PaaS. Let's prove to you that I'm actually connected to a domain and that the domain controller has those VMs as part of them. And I'm going to do that by going to that Web Apps Manager one, and I'm going to connect to it. And then from there, I'm going to RDP into the domain controller, which is also where the VPN device management is. And I'm going to get the IP address of the domain controller by going over to configure and looking at the DNS servers, because the domain controller is also acting as the DNS server. And there it is. You can see 192.168.1.6. And here I am. And let me do a remote. Whoops. And then here you can see that IP address, 192.168.1.6. And let me log into the domain controller. And once I've logged into the domain controller, you can see here's the Cisco admin tool for the VPN device. You can see there's the gateway, and here's the remote network. We've called it Azure Network. And then if I run Active Directory users and computers, I will see in the computers node all of those VMs here. Here's Web Apps Manager 1, Web Apps Manager 2, there's the SQL and the SQL Server Witness. So those machines are domain joined, and actually when I logged into that website, I was logging in with a domain account. And that's through the power of the virtual network plus the virtual network gateway feature. And then we just have a few minutes here left. I wanted to, again, highlight the fact that we see infrastructure as a service, this virtual machine features, as an on-ramp. And there's going to be applications that people move to the cloud that are infrastructure as a service based, where it's a line of business app. It's been chugging along, doing its job. We just want to get rid of our on-premise infrastructure and put it up into the cloud. And we'll never touch it again. It's going to live out its life happily cruising along as infrastructure as a service. Then there's going to be bigger applications, more important to the company, line of business and customer facing, where they start out as infrastructure as a service and then over time migrate to platform as a service as developers, the IT developers, continue to invest in making the application more robust and cloud scale. And I've got a demonstration of that transition with that application I was just showing you, because one of the things you can do is I can take and I can connect two cloud services, a platform as a service front end over here, which is a web role, with a SQL back end. So that might be the first thing that I'd migrate, is that front end, because it's just stateless IIS, and that very easy to migrate into platform as a service. How easy is it? Let's go take a look at the application for Web Apps Manager, and I'll show you. Oops. I'll show you just how easy it is to migrate that application, which is just a simple ASP.NET web app. Here it is, events.web. And we've made it possible in Visual Studio for you to say, add Windows Azure Cloud Service Project. And what that will do is wrap it inside of a web role. And that's what I did with this application. And then I've uploaded it to Windows Azure. And if we go to this Cloud Fabricam Cloud Service and go to instances, you can see I've got two instances of the web role. And that is this right here, which I've already opened. Let me log into this version. And we're going to take a look at the connection string as well as the machine name. Remember I told you for platform as a service, we don't worry about the machine name because platform as a service doesn't talk machine names. It talks platform as a service APIs. So if we scroll down, we can see here's the Azure assigned virtual machine name, because this is a platform as a service. But you can see that I'm using the same SQL connection string. Now this is hybrid. It's platform as a service front end, infrastructure as a service back end. And as the final step, I might take that SQL server database and migrate it into SQL Azure. Then I simply change the connection string, and I've got another deployment of that application now. With that database migrated into SQL Azure, and so we're going to see the same list of events because we just migrated the database. And in the connection string, though, you're going to see instead of the SQL Server mirror connection string, you're going to see the SQL Azure connection string down here. So there's the PaaS machine name. And then you can see here's the SQL Server connection string down here. So this application now has shown, starting in pure infrastructure as a service, to the front end being platform as a service, to now the front end and the back end. And again, all of these instances are domain joined with VNet, so I've logged in with the same domain credentials into all three versions using that capability. And so that brings me to the end. And again, just to wrap up by reviewing the list of things that we set out to accomplish when we started developing this feature, IT Pro, you can see IT Pro experience, PowerShell scripting supported throughout the stack. So I demonstrated creating that 16 terabyte VM using PowerShell script to support for applications like SQL Server, SharePoint, Active Directory. The storage manageability we get by basing our VHD storage on Windows Azure Storage so that you can use off-the-shelf storage tools. You can copy VMs, VHDs from Azure back to on-premise. You can copy Hyper-V VHDs from on-premise up into Azure and then launch virtual machines off them. You can back them up the way that you can saw me do very easily. It's got high availability features with the load balance sets, with the availability sets. We've got networking features like the support for all the protocols as well as the virtual networking, ability to connect different cloud services together securely as well as connect through a tunnel from on-premise using a VPN device, and then finally integration with PaaS in a bunch of different ways to support that transition from infrastructure as a service to platform as a service. So with that, I want to thank you very much for coming. I hope you found this interesting and look at possibilities for you, yourself, and your customers for running infrastructure as a service on Windows Azure as part of the transition we're all going to make to the cloud. So thanks very much, and I hope you have a great TechEd.